Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field. I'm your host. And today we're going to be talking with Craig Hadley, who is the director of the Angels Camp Museum. Now, you probably know that Angels Camp is in Calaveras County on Highway 49 south of Jackson on the road to Yosemite. It's a beautiful area. Amador, Calaveras, and Tuolumne counties are all just spectacular. But you might ask, this is an author's show. This is where I interview writers. Why am I doing a show about a museum? Well, the show is called Manzanita Voices, and I can't think of a better voice for our culture and our society than a museum. Every exhibit in the Angels Camp Museum speaks to us with its own voice and tells us about where we came from. Craig is here today to tell us about all the changes that are coming to the museum. So I'm really hoping that this program will motivate you to come to Angels Camp and see the museum and become more familiar with your history. Now, Craig is going to be giving the website information for the museum. All you have to remember to do anytime you listen to the show, if you want information that my guest gives out about how to get to their website or how to buy their book, all you have to remember to do is go to my website and I'll have it there for you. It's manzamedia.com, manzamedia.com. I have a date book section telling about events that are of interest to writers and people who love books. And I have previous shows archived on the website too. Right now they're under show listings. Now, because we're going to be talking about museum and history and everything, I thought that for the morning workout, I would read from the chapbook by Charlotte Muse. She was a guest on this show several months ago. And Charlotte's chapbook is called A Story Also Grows. And it's about the words of Ascension Solorzano, who was a Native American woman who lived down in the Gilroy area. Her life spanned two centuries. She died in 1930 as a very old woman. She was the last fluent native speaker of the Mutsun language. And she was very instrumental in passing the story and the history of her people on to all of us. Charlotte was so inspired by the story of Ascension that she wrote a series of poems about Ascension and the stories that she had told. And by the way, Ascension's stories and Charlotte's book are on display in the Smithsonian Museum. So here's another museum tie. Ascension thought that she was dying, and so she went to bed. And she announced that she was going to pass away. And the Smithsonian, having already been aware of her, sent someone out very quickly to talk with her and try to write down all the information that they could hear from her. Well, Ascension lived on for several more months, and she told story after story after story, and that's how they came to be recorded for posterity, for all of us. And so next time you go to Washington, D.C., if you go to the Smithsonian, look up the exhibit that tells about Ascension. So, let me tell you a little bit about this poem in Charlotte's chapbook that I'm going to read. Living in this part of California, we're all familiar with the Indian grinding rocks, where they ground their acorns. Ascension said this about the grinding rocks. People used to say that the pounding places in the big rocks were not made by the Indians, but that they found them like they are in the mountains and only cleaned them out well and began to use them. They had been there since the beginning of the world. And when there was world already, there were these pounding places. When it rained, they used to fill with water. Ascension Solorzano. So this is Charlotte's poem called Pounding Places. Once, the first people found them, scooped out the dead leaves, scraped out soil with a stick, then scrubbed the rock bowls clean. The women crouched over in their reed skirts, pounding acorns into flour. The solitary hunter naked, breaking up a small rabbit, bones and all. If you are afraid or in mourning or believe you should have saved someone, if you've poured yourself out and forgotten wildness, if you can't sleep, remember these hidden basins in the mountains. The people are gone now, only shadows in the leaves, but the rock bowls are still there. Each year, on short winter days, the rain washes all debris away. If you found one on a sunny day, the water would show you your face, the trees above it, the blue air. Nights, when the moon lends them its eye, the pools receive light and return it as we do love. Their receptivity, a gift made use of. Now, from Ascension Solorzano to Angels Camp Museum, here's my interview with Craig Hadley. I took my studio on the road again, went to the museum, and we recorded our show. As we were doing the program, I did not notice that there was a clock ticking in the room. I only discovered it later as I was editing the program. At first, I was very upset that I had let that noise intrude on the interview. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. It's a clock ticking in the museum. That's kind of appropriate. So you'll hear the clock reminding us that time passes and it's important to save things. Craig Hadley, welcome to Manzanita Voices.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're really happy to have you with us. Tell me, what are the new things that you have going on at the museum for the coming summer?
Well, we just have a lot of things going on here. We're right in the middle of building and completing our new artisans exhibit, which we hope to have done at least the first phase of it by the end of July. And we'll actually have a fully operational textiles area, 19th century carpenter shop, and a early 20th century print shop that's fully functional. And then by the end of August, we hope to have the blacksmith shop built and operational as well.
That's fabulous. Is that print shop going to have the old-fashioned?
Oh, yeah. It'll be hand-set type, and we have a hand press, and we have a jobbing press, the old styles that were used both in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And we'll be able to set type by hand, which is upside down and backwards, and we'll be able to demonstrate it for the general public and show how it's all done. We've got the type cabinets and the printer stone and the whole nine yards.
Was it hard to find someone to operate the machinery?
Actually, no. That was actually the first thing we found. It turns out that our museum commission president, Bob Pettyhone, is an old printer, and he knew a bunch of other old printers. And they formed a committee to start this project. In fact, it was the first of the artisan exhibits that was organized. And then I actually, myself, when I was in high school, worked on an old 1923 Channel 1 price press and used to set type upside down and backwards. I was what was called a devil's apprentice.
You know, the museum is really lucky to have you. You've been here for 17 months, and you've made a lot of changes. And if people are familiar with Angels Camp at all, they know that driving by on Highway 49 on South Main Street, coming into the old part of Angels Camp, if they're coming from, say, the Jackson area, the museum would be on their left. And it's a little building set off from the highway. However, that's just the original building, and the museum itself is on how many acres, and what buildings do you have here?
Well, we have almost 4 acres and 35,000 square feet of exhibit space. People actually, they see just a little original 1950 block building. They don't realize the property is terraced. So we have like a 10,000 square foot carriage house. We have another 10,000 square foot building with ranching and mining equipment that will also hold the artisan's equipment. We have outdoor exhibits all over the property. People often don't see the museum as they drive by. They'll see an old steam engine out front called the Jenny, and I'll catch that and they'll miss the museum. But we're right across the street from Rock Restaurant, and don't let the front of the museum fool you.
Yeah, because the hill slopes down. The museum is on property that slopes down away from Highway 49 Main Street, and so what you notice is that beautiful old engine out front, the Jenny, you said.
The Jenny, the old Jenny. Yeah, she's a steam engine that would have used to carry ore cars, and her boiler was built in Scotland back in the 19th century. So, but people see that and they don't see past it because it's so quick and they go by.
Yeah, it really catches your eye. So when you do drive by, just look a little further beyond the engine and you'll see it looks like a little house with a front porch and everything, but it's a museum building. And the carriage house down the hill behind the front building has a fabulous display. There are some gorgeous carriages in there and an old undertaker's carriage and a beautiful new exhibit on loan. It's a stagecoach. Tell us about that stagecoach.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating piece. We just got in on a long-term loan from the Native Sons of the Golden West, and it is an original stagecoach. It's a Concord coach that was built sometime between 1848 and 1859, and it was actually written about by Mark Twain in the book Roughing It. It had Hank Monk as the stagecoach driver, and it carried Horace Greeley on the part of his trip from Genoa to Placerville. and it's been fully restored. We have also over 30 restored carriages in the carriage house, as well as a 1911 Ford touring car and a 1925 chemical engine fire truck that takes us up through the horse's carriage period.
Tell us more about that stagecoach driver.
Oh, Hank Monk was probably one of the most famous of the stagecoach drivers that existed in the 19th century in California. He was famous for his colorful language as well as his skill as a coach driver. As Mark Twain tells the story with Horace Greeley, that Greeley was late for a speaking engagement at Placerville and told Monk about it. And Monk spit a piece of chaw and hit the reins with the horses, and next thing you know, they were flying across the mountain roads faster than they expected, and was bouncing Greeley all over the place. Greeley panicked and began to tell Monk, "Forget about it, I don't need to be there." Monk wouldn't hear anything of it, bounced him around so hard that his head went through the ceiling of the stagecoach. But he got him there on time for his lecture.
Do you think that maybe Greeley had ticked him off a little bit, and that was why he gave him such a hard ride?
My guess is that was Monk's sense of humor in play at that point. Like, if you don't think I'm doing a good enough job, well, then all right, man. We'll see how fast we can go. But he was very famous and drove a number of coaches and stagecoaches all the way through the 19th century.
There's a marvelous bust of Mark Twain here in the museum. It is so lifelike. It's amazing.
We have a small exhibit on Mark Twain's life here at the museum. However, we are looking to build a large exhibit on Twain downstairs in time for 2015, which is the 150th anniversary of Twain visiting Angels Camp and hearing the Jumping Frog story. And that will likely be a $200,000 to $300,000 project that we'll be looking to start to raise money for next year. But it'll be state-of-the-art, multimedia, and have a lot of, it'll focus entirely just on Twain's life in the Gold Country, not his life before or not his life after. And that is something that's kind of one of my pet peeves that I see here in California, everything from Virginia City to San Francisco, even Angels Camp, is that people always tend to portray and talk about Twain as the 70-year-old humorist. Well, he was 29, 30 years old when he was here. He was a young man. He was down on his luck, bit of a scoundrel, misfit, and trying his chance at fame and fortune. And I think a lot of people would rather hear about that Twain and the Twain they don't know about. The guy who had just a single dime left to his name, sitting in the Angels Camp Hotel, sitting back, smoking a pipe or cigar, while listening to the story of the Jumping Frog, and beginning to, in his mind, curl the idea of writing it as a story to be published. And it ended up being the first major story published by him that traveled across the United States in syndication.
Yeah, so it kind of put Mark Twain on the map, didn't it? I mean, it's what made him famous.
Oh, yeah. His entire literary career started with this Jumping Frog story. And it was the very first book was published by him in 1867, was The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, and other short stories that he had written. But it was that story that first got him national notoriety. So you can say that that Jumping Frog story that he heard named his camp launched Mark Twain's literary career.
That's just right. Just think, if he had never come to Angel's Camp, he might never have become well known. I'd like to think that he would, because he wrote so many other great things too, but it was our frog that gave him his start.
Stay with us. We'll be right back with more from Craig Hadley.
Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. Okay, so we were talking about Mark Twain, and I know that one of the first times I ever came here to the museum in Angels Camp, I went into the little room off to the left as you come in the front door, and there is a video set up in there where you can watch this fabulously entertaining video of the Jumping Frog event that we have every year in Angels Camp. Want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It's a documentary film called Jump, and it chronicles and documents the Jumping Frog competition at the Calaveras County Fair that we have every May. And it gives a little bit of the history as well as some of the more funny anecdotes and stories that have gone along there. It's a 90-minute video that we let guests come in, and they just sit for a few minutes or sit as long as they want to watch it. And, of course, the whole room is surrounded by Jumping Frog paraphernalia, photographs of past events, and even some of the famous folks that have visited here during the Jumping Frog competition. And we're planning on, as part of that new Mark Twain exhibit downstairs, there's going to be a room devoted to the history of the frog jump that will be a lot more comprehensive. It includes photographs of all the different celebrities from Big Gary Cooper and Edward G. Robinson all the way up to Larry the Cable Guy, who've come out for and a lot of people don't realize there's a lot of famous celebrities who have entered frogs, who not necessarily have come, but have sent frogs up with representatives to enter into the Jumping Frog competition. And so they're going to tell that story as well. And why the story of the Jumping Frog was so significant.
And you mentioned Gary Cooper. Now, Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly were here in Calaveras County, and they made their movie here, right? High Noon. Do you have any memorabilia from their visit?
Yeah, we actually have a photograph that we'll have in the new exhibit. That's actually a picture of Gary Cooper in his High Noon outfit in Jamestown, where they were shooting the film. And it shows him reading a copy of the Jumping Frog story while holding a bullfrog in his other hand with a very quizzical, confused look on his face.
I guess he was a pretty nice guy. He seems to have been very well liked when he was here. And Grace Kelly as well, of course. Now, I know that you've instituted some new events here at the museum, and I've been lucky enough to come and take part in some of them. You have the first Thursday of the month lecture series that is really great. I've heard some wonderful stuff. Tell us about some of the presentations that you've had.
Oh, yeah. Well, we initiated this near the end of last year. I think we started in October of last year. We do the first Thursday of every month. And right now we're doing them at the museum in our carriage house. We've had a lot of great speakers that have come out and spoken on all sorts of topics, from the history of Indians Camp to the importance of Civil War in California, to gold mining techniques. But then we've got a history of winemaking in Calaveras County coming up. We'll have, we're looking to do a cemetery tour in October, telling stories. And the best place to find out what we're doing and when we're doing it is if you go to the Angels Camp Museum Foundation website, which is www.angelscampmuseumfoundation.org. I know it's a mouthful, but angelscampmuseumfoundation.org. And there is a tab for the lecture series that will give you the dates of the lecture series. And the lecture starts at 7 o'clock. We open the doors at 6:30, and we have free complimentary refreshments of usually wine and some hors d'oeuvres and water.
And there was one wonderful evening where you had three older folks from the community, and they were telling about life in Calaveras County when they were kids. And I have to say, that was the most entertaining evening. It was just fabulous.
Oh, yeah. That was what it was called, Memories of Angels Camp. Yeah. And one of the talkers was 101 years old. He actually was 16 years old when the first Jumping Frog competition took place in 1928. So, yeah, we have some colorful characters in this town who have no compulsion to not tell the truth and tell everything and just lay it out and whatever. So some great stories that night. And we videotaped it for posterity to keep those oral histories alive. And, it's just one of the many things we're trying to do here at Angels Camp at the museum. And that is to be a resource to the community and not just a standalone institution. And one of the ways of being a resource is making people like that available for the community to hear.
Now, Craig, we don't just have the museum and its several buildings here on this 4-acre parcel in Angels Camp. There are some other sort of off-campus exhibits, too. What are they?
Well, we have the Alterville Schoolhouse, which is a mid-19th century one-room schoolhouse. That is also under our care, and we opened the front door to that up the same day the museum is open, Thursday through Monday from 10 to 4, so people can stop there and take a look inside. We're hoping to hold more activities and public activities there in the coming year.
Now, that's in Alterville.
Alterville is essentially Angels Camp. I mean, it was annexed essentially by Angels Camp a number of years ago, so it, when you come into Angels Camp city limits, it'll actually be on your right if you're coming from like San Andreas or Jackson. And it's just before you get to the fire station and the McDonald's, and you can't miss it.
Okay, what's another off-campus attraction?
Well, it's not an attraction quite yet. We just acquired the Sam Choi building. That's a mid-19th century Chinese mercantile building that was owned by a Chinese immigrant by the name of Sam Choi, who operated it for the Chinese immigrants that were working in the gold mines and the gold camps. And he operated that mercantile for almost 30 years until he sold it to an Italian immigrant family who continued to operate it in the area until about 1926, that Chinese prostitute then worked out of there until the city finally bought the property in the early 1950s. At that point, it was, I actually have that backwards. I mean, the Chinese prostitute, I think, worked there from the turn of the 20th century till 1926. Then the city actually acquired the building in 1926, and it operated it as a jail. They re-outfitted it with bars and everything. It was kind of a drunk tank. And it ended up operating as a jail till 1956 when state law changed, said that it couldn't just have a standalone facility without anybody manning it. And at that point, the city started leasing it out to businesses. We actually acquired it this last July, and we plan on a long-range 10-year plan to eventually restore the building and compile a Chinese collection, which we have started, to then display the building as a Chinese mercantile as it might have appeared in, say, 1860 or 65.
Well, that's going to be really interesting. So what do you know about Sam Choi?
Well, he was quite the entrepreneur. He, we've looked at some of the land plat from the land plat office, from the tax assessor's office, and he owned a lot of property in Angel's Camp. So he acquired quite a bit of wealth, and he was sending a lot of it back to China to his family. He had a young daughter who, I believe at the age of 10, even though they were living here, he had her feet broken, his feet bound, like they did in the old traditional way. And then by the time she was, I believe, 14, he ended up shipping her back to China to be educated and kind of kept by the family to keep the old ways alive. Did not like the idea of her becoming westernized. And so a little heartbreaking story, especially when you read there were letters that were written to Sam from her friends who were begging him not to send her back to China and the Lu, and of course that didn't change things. He had bound her feet, which was a horrible practice back then, and shipped her back off, and we don't know what ever happened to her after that.
I can't imagine going through that. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Craig Hadley and more on Angel's Camp and the museum. And, well, this is a really learned guy. I want to hear something about before he came to Angel's Camp. We'll be back. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're talking today with Craig Hadley. We've been talking about the Angel's Camp Museum, and you know, the reason I wanted to talk to Craig today about this is that we're looking at the beginning of summertime, and a lot of people are going to be coming to Calaveras County on their vacations. I am really hoping that you're going to stop by this little museum in Angel's Camp, because I just said the wrong word. It is not a little museum. It is big. It only looks little from the road. So make sure you stop and give it some time. I would say give it at least 2 or 3 hours. You will find that you'll want to spend more, because there is so much to see here. I mean, how about having a chance to see the blacksmiths and people weaving and at looms and making clothing and the woodworkers? Oh, and the print shop. Bring your kids. There is so much for them to learn. And I can't think of a better voice for society than a museum, because every exhibit in here speaks to us of our own past. So come and say hi to Craig and visit the museum. You won't be sorry. And you might even join the museum. Become a supporter. They're trying to raise money to do a lot of great things here, and you can help. Now, Craig, you are a museum director, and your wife is also a museum director. Where's her museum?
Well, my wife, Jessie, is the executive director of the Tahoe Maritime Museum up in Lake Tahoe. It's located in Homewood on the West Shore. And here. So yes, we live in a split household at the moment. I commute back and forth between Tahoe and Angels Camp for the time being. And she's got a great museum. It carries a lot of classic wooden boats, and it deals with the history of boating on Lake Tahoe. And right now they just unveiled a new exhibit called Tahoe 20s, which has, they've got boats on display that were built in the 1920s and used on Lake Tahoe. They also have a 1920s ride boat, I believe it's called Let Me Go First, that was built in the early 20s that you can actually pay to go out on the lake and have a ride on an original 20s wooden boat.
You folks are not from California, are you? You're from back east, both of you?
No, my wife is a California, native California. Raised until she was 9 in South Lake Tahoe, and then spent the rest of her youth being raised in Southern California in La Quinta, which is near Palm Springs. And I'm originally from back east. I'm from South Carolina. I relocated out here from Charleston, South Carolina, Charleston, as we like to call it, South Carolina. And my wife gets amused when my southernness accent comes out occasionally from time to time. But my wife and I met, 8-9 years ago. She was in graduate school at the Citadel outside of Charleston.
Hmm.
And I was working at the time for the National Trust for Historic Preservation as their director of education and research at their Great Hall site. And I actually hired her as a part-time interpreter. And I hired her and helped train her and got her start in the museum field. And she couldn't stand the sight of me, and I thought she was a stuck-up California blonde, and so we were destined to get married one day.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, so took a little longer, though.
So who is the first one who came to their senses and realized, hey, that person's not so bad?
You know, it was me. We met, we hooked up again, I think, at a conference, and years later, and I was like, let's have a drink, and I was like, you know, you're not as much of a
stuck-up
blonde as I thought you were, and she said, you're not as much of a jerk as I thought you were, and that started it all. So we got married on 10-10-10 in South Lake Tahoe. And she's just great. She's really smart. Having another museum director in the family is actually very helpful. We bounce ideas off of each other. We're very different directors, very, very different types of directors and styles. It helps. So that way, if I have an idea for an exhibit, I bounce it off of her and vice versa. And we help each other. We complement each other very well.
So what's your style as a museum director?
My style is that I like going into museums that have tremendous amount of potential that they haven't reached yet, and taking that museum to its full potential. My wife tends to be more she likes to work for museums that are like fairly new, that are a lot more have their act together, so to speak. So, you know, when I came here to Angels Camp, I moved up this way just because my wife, I was at the time executive director of the General Patton Museum in Southern California. My wife was director of the Coachella Valley History Museum. She got offered the job at the Lake Tahoe Museum, and she said, you know, you'd have to quit your job if we took it. I told her it was too good of an opportunity, so she took it. We moved up, and then I started looking, and then Angels Camp was looking for a director. Came down and interviewed, and then as soon as I got a tour of the museum and saw the collection, I fell in love. I was like, this museum has such potential. And I saw in my head instantly what this museum could eventually become one day. And so at that point, that's when I knew I wanted to come here. And unfortunately, the museum commission felt the same way. And I'm very passionate about what I do. I have to love what I do and do what I love. And I am fortunate that I'm at a place where I can do that. And I literally dream what this museum is going to look like in 5 years. I really do. Every time we start a new exhibit project, I literally dream of what it's going to look like. I'm that excited about it.
And you even mentioned a 15-year plan to me, so you're planning way in the future. You have all kinds of dreams for this place. And I know you're going to make it happen. I have been picking Craig's brain about the Civil War. You're a military historian. So where did you go to school, and did you always know you wanted to study the military and their history?
Ever since I was 16 years old, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. Got my passion at Gettysburg on a family trip to Gettysburg. So that was where it started.
I remember this story. Would you please tell the listeners?
We were on a family trip, a summer trip to Washington, D.C., and we went to Gettysburg. And it was near the end of the day at the park. My family wanted to see the diorama and was in the old visitor center. And I walked out and decided I wanted to walk alone. And I was up on the cemetery ridge. And as I was walking between two cannon, I almost tripped. And I looked down what I had tripped on, and I saw a spent mini ball half sticking out of the ground. I remember going down and picking it up. And instantly, the moment I touched it, it suddenly occurred to me I was the first person to touch this since it had been fired in anger in July of 1863. And it made me suddenly wonder, who fired it? How old was it? Was he my age? Did he survive? Who did it hit anybody? What was their story? And suddenly I could hear the sound of musketry and the yelling of men, and I looked across the open field and I could see a long gray line of the mist coming at me. And I got goosebumps in the back of my neck. And at that point forward, I was hooked. I knew that history is what I wanted to study, and it started with military history. So my first passion was the American Civil War, and it just went on from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you also know a lot about the Revolutionary War. That's probably the second category of history that you've studied.
And World War
II. And you have a couple of books that you're working on.
Yeah, I've got one book that's in the editorial process at the University of South Carolina Press called South Carolinians in Uniform, 1674 to 1945. And then I've got another book I've been working on for a number of years on the history of the 2nd Minnesota Regiment. I also have a privately published book that I wrote for a World War II veteran on a gentleman by the name of Oscar Fitzhenry, who was a B-24 Liberator pilot in the Pacific during World War II. And I'm currently also working on a book by contract on the history of Chiraco Summit, which is in Southern California.
Chiraco Summit. Okay, a lot of people don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's the kind of the epicenter for the Desert Training Center that General George Patton established during World War II to train the Army in preparation for the invasion of North Africa. And the gentleman who founded Chiraco Summit in the 30s, his name was Joe Chiraco. His family's still there. He also founded the General Patton Memorial Museum, which is based there as well.
Very interesting. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. By the way, the museum website again is
www.angelscampmuseumfoundation.org.
If you didn't get that, go to my website, manzamedia.com. I'll have all the information on there. Okay, Craig, now you are quite an educator. You love to study history. You love to talk about it. You teach it. You've taught a lot of fabulous courses. What is your background in all this?
Well, I kind of come around to it in a very roundabout way. Well, I went to the University of South Carolina. That's where I eventually graduated from the University of South Carolina with a degree both in anthropology and history. But I also studied in England and in Washington, D.C., did an internship at Smithsonian, did graduate work at the College of William and Mary, and I worked as a professional field director of archaeology for a number of years. Then
where?
All over. I mean, I worked for a couple of different what they call cultural resource management firms, and I did archaeology in the entire Southeast, New York State, Wyoming. I even did some projects in Oregon and Northern California back in the early 90s. Then got sick of living out of a tent in a hotel 9 to 10 months out of the year, and that's when I got into museum work and consulting. And my first museum was the Creative Discovery Museum in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where I helped design the archaeology and paleontology exhibit for children. And so I got into education with kids, with museum education, museum exhibits. I worked as a consultant for the History Channel. I had my own consulting company for a number of years where I produced documentary films and did also restoration work. I restored mid-19th century African-American slave houses and some other things.
Where did you do that?
Charleston, South Carolina. Magnolia Plantation was my last big project. I restored 5 1850 slave cabins to various time periods and then created the interpretive programs for it. It basically did a little bit of everything, consulting with other museums around the country and helping them with both exhibits, long-range planning, strategic planning, and the like, historical interpretation. And then, you know, I was also a Civil War reenactor for 20-something years. I also did American Revolution living history and worked with national parks and state parks, and just basically a jack-of-all-trades. And everything I've done in the last 30 years has been kind of a different tool for my toolbox that always helps me, and sometimes in surprising ways that I never expected.
Do you see why I said that Angel's Camp is lucky to have this guy? I know that Craig's favorite subject is the Civil War. So why don't we talk a little bit about the Civil War? We actually talked about it for an hour and a half before we started the interview, but I'm sure you have a little bit more to say. The Civil War was a really tragic event in our history. Could it have been averted?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. That's one of the things historians love to do is be what-ifs. The downside of what-ifs is that you'll never know. And, I mean, it's the same with that particular question. I mean, there are historians who postulated that, you know, if Lincoln hadn't won the election, or if the South had been able to be convinced that Lincoln wasn't going to change the state of slavery in the country, that slavery would have petered out on itself within the next 20 years. It was already becoming economically unviable.
That's what everybody, a lot of people in the North were thinking, was that slavery was going to come to an end on its own anyway. Is that really a certainty?
Oh, no, nothing is certain. And I mean, that's the thing, is you know, we can postulate about that, and it's fun to banter around those ideas and those theories. And historians love to do that. Sit around a table and talk about the what-ifs. Oh, you know, what if Lee had made this flanking maneuver at Chancellorsville, or blah, blah, blah. I mean, what if Stonewall Jackson had not died? I mean, you know, what would have happened? Mm-hmm. What would happen if the South had won? I mean, there's a thousand things you can postulate, but the truth is that history is history. There are three different kinds of history. There is mythical history that people love to talk about, and it's not real history. There's the academic history that is taught in schools, and then is what we call what really happened. Mm-hmm. And it's almost impossible to know what really happened, because history is not objective, it's subjective, always.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know...
That's why it depends on who is doing the recounting of the tale, right?
Well, yeah, and I mean, I like to call popular history what I call now is history according to Hollywood. And that is, people today think they know history, but what their subconscious, what they think is history is actually their subconscious pulling up every movie they've seen about a particular topic. So say you're sitting down and talking about the Civil War. Well, subconsciously, your brain is pulling up everything from Gone with the Wind to Gettysburg to Glory, to the North and the South, the Blue and the Gray, anything you have seen. And so you think you're having this intelligent conversation about American Civil War history, when the truth is probably 90% of what you're reciting is probably false. And it's pretty much with any historical topic today, especially with any generation 40 years of age and younger, is that people tend to think their history is more coming from Hollywood movies than actually reading about it. So it's fun for me to sit there and go to a historical film or a historically based film and look at how much is wrong with it as opposed to how much is right with it.
I've heard it said that there has been a book written about the Civil War for every day that has passed since the war ended. There are a lot of books out there. One of the writers that I first read was John Jakes. He's a pretty popular writer on this subject. What's your opinion of his rendition of the history?
Probably just what you said, his rendition of history. You know, he's a great storyteller. Not a great historian. I mean, and you have to, as a historian, you have to. It's the same with a film. When you're looking at a film or reading a book or a novel about a historical topic, you have to look at the intent of the writer or the intent of the filmmaker. If the intent of the writer is not to try to be historically accurate, but he's just wanting to tell a fascinating story, you can forgive that. Same with the intent of a filmmaker. But if the intent, if they're actually trying to be historically accurate and they're not, then that's when I have a problem. Or they're at least giving the illusion or leading the reader or the watcher of the film that it's supposed to be historically correct. Then I have a problem with it. So you have to kind of look at the intent of the writer and the filmmaker. So John Jenks, he's not professing to be a historian. He's not professing to tell that this is a history. He is saying, this is a great romance novel, this is a great, you know, that's set during this time period, blah, blah, blah. Then you can forgive that. However, if he was trying to claim himself a historian, and that he's writing this, and this is a story he's telling, then yeah, I have a problem with it.
Okay, well let me throw another name out there, Shelby Foote. He was featured so much in the documentary, the Civil War documentary, and he has written three huge books on the war, at least, maybe more than I know about. And he was a friend of yours. Want to tell a little bit about Shelby Foote?
Well, Shelby was a fantastic author. He never, you know, what's interesting is that the three-volume set of the Civil War that he wrote other smaller works on the Civil War, are basically the cornerstone, I think, of one of the best Civil War histories ever written. However, Shelby never professed to be a historian, and he used to get upset with people who tried to pigeonhole him that way. He considered himself a Southern writer and a novelist. And when he started writing those books, he wanted to tell a fascinating story, but he wanted to tell it accurately. And he started and it unfolded into the great epic work that it is. And he wanted to be historically accurate, so he did all the research, he did footnotes, he did everything to try to make it as correct as possible. But by being a Southern writer and not a historian, it's not a dry academic work. He took it from the perspective of being a writer, and he fleshed out the characters, fleshed out the people, and it's probably the best read. Now, it's daunting. I mean, you're going to read, you know, more than 3,000, 4,000 pages worth of writing, but if you're wanting the kind of epitome work on the Civil War, Shelby's the man to read. But he was a really, really true Southern gentleman in every sense of the word.
You have a great story about how he did not like, he did not suffer fans well. He did not like to be recognized or to have people come tracking him down. And there was one time when people did come to his door.
Well, Shelby refused to let celebrity interfere with his life. And so I used to bother him about self-time, but he had his name and address and phone number just published in the phone book. I mean, it wasn't private or anything. And I would go, Shelby, you know, people are going to take advantage of that. And he would just like, Greg, I'm not going to let it change my life. And he told this story about one of kind of the most epitome stories. He was in the midst of finishing writing the Civil War trilogy that he was working on. And he had just finished writing about Lincoln's death and assassination. And he had just finished, Lincoln had just died. And he finished at that moment, and he was misty-eyed and was very moved emotionally. The character was so personal to him now from writing about it. And all of a sudden, there was this frantic knock at the door. Yeah. He goes to the front door, opens it, and instantly there's a flash in his face from a camera. And there's this tourist family there with a Bermuda shorts and the whole nine yards. And they stick a pad of one of his books in front of him with a pen and ask for an autograph. And he and Shelby says, you know, the moment was shattered. That moment of Lincoln's death was shattered. And he just slammed the door in his people's faces. And I mean, it's just kind of You know, he enjoyed certain things about his celebrity, but he did not like that part about being a celebrity. He did not like people bothering him or interfering with him. But, you know, that was him. He was kind of a bit of a curmudgeon in that way.
Well, there you have it from Craig Hadley. I suggest that you come to the Angels Camp Museum, and if you're lucky, Craig will be here, and you can get him in a corner, get him talking about the Civil War or just about any other historical topic, and you're going to be entertained. I don't think he'll slam the door in your face. Craig, it's been wonderful talking with you. I hope that this conversation we've had today will do a lot to bring listeners to Calaveras County and the Angels Camp so that they can come and see your marvelous museum.
Thank you for having me, Linda. We look forward to people visiting.
Thank you, Craig. Everybody out there, have a nice week. See you next time.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.